recording Monday, May 28th in Boulder Creek, California at my home. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geek Speak. Zach Schwarzbach holds an Associates of Arts from my alma mater, Cabrillo College. He holds a BA in Political Science and Government from Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and a Doctor of Law from Santa Clara University School of Law. Zach is a parent and an avid volunteer in education and kids' sports. For the last 10 years, Zach has been an attorney at Bigham, Christensen, and Minsloff, focusing on criminal defense in jury trials. Zach Schwarzbach is a public defender for Santa Cruz County and is currently running for judge. Elections are Tuesday, June 3rd?
5th.
5th, June 5th. I should have known June 5th. It's Tuesday. Well, Zach, thanks so much for coming to my home and chatting with me about tech and law.
Thanks for having me. Excited.
You're a public defender, which means that Santa Cruz County pays your bills when you're representing a defendant, right?
Right. So I'm an employee of a law firm, but Santa Cruz County doesn't have a public defender office, so they contract with our firm. And so I'm an employee of the firm, and then they have a contract worked out with Santa Cruz County. And
is that common for small counties?
Yes. I think there's a handful of counties that do that in California. It has to do with population size. But I guess we're moving towards, potentially in the future, it'll be a public office.
Uh-huh. And so you normally are represented because, the defendant needs needs support from the government for their defense, or because they pay for themselves?
No, exactly. So when you watch some movie where somebody gets arrested and they read them the rights, you have a right to an attorney. If you can't afford one will be provided for you. Well, that's where I come in.
I'm the one provided for you. You're the dude.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
And you've been doing this for like 10 years?
10 and a half years. I worked as an intern for a couple of years before that.
But yeah.
As an attorney.
Doing the same similar things?
Yeah, initially I started doing like research and writing, and then once you can get certified as a law student by the state bar, and you can actually go to court and make appearances under the supervision of a senior attorney, and so I started doing that, and actually got to do a couple jury trials before I finished law school, which was...
Wow, and that's a common thing, which means that like the other lawyer is kind of the real lawyer, and you're like an assistant, like a TA in a teaching situation.
Exactly, and I was really lucky to have some mentors that gave me a lot of room and gave me a lot of opportunity but for doing those trials before finishing school, I don't think I would have gotten hired right after passing the bar by our office. So I had kind of demonstrated that I could do the work.
And your office does a lot of other things besides public defending, of course.
It's probably like 99% of what we do. Yeah. It's a criminal defense firm. We can take private cases. I've represented private clients. There are some attorneys who do a little bit more of that, but it's, I would say 98-99% of the work is appointed work.
And are you the sole contractor for the County of Santa Cruz?
There are two other firms that provide a similar service. We refer to them as the conflict firms. So if we have a conflict of an interest in a case and we can't represent somebody, they will get, depending on the date that their case is in.
What kind of conflict would emerge?
So sometimes you might have co-defendants, so multiple people getting charged with the same crime.
And you want to represent one of them.
Yeah, it would be, if I can't, it might be in one co-defendant's interest to point the finger at the other guy. And I can't, if I'm representing both of them, I can't counsel him to do something that's going to hurt my
other. And so you don't even start the case that way, because in case that's a way you want to deal with it. You want to start off fresh with a clean representation.
Right. Step one is we do a conflicts check to make sure that none of the witnesses are people that we represent, that there's no co-defendant that we represent.
Okay, so you engage with many people who are dealing with decisions they have made in their life, or their victims, or their decisions they've made in their life where they have done something that led them down a path of something that means they're involved with the law.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that most of the time in your life, you're not dealing with that thing yourself personally. Do you ever think, what if? Like you see this person and you're like, wow, that could have been me if I had done these decisions. Does that ever feel that way?
Oh yeah. I really think that I encounter people and they'll ask me how do you do the work you do? And they're coming from a perspective of the people I represent are something other than what they are. And which is not the case. We're all human beings. And I've definitely like looked at people and recognized that, I had great parents, I had a great upbringing. My life has been fantastic. But for one of these things, I certainly could have ended up doing something that would have gotten me in trouble and potentially prosecuted. Absolutely.
Do you think of that as just a luck situation?
I mean, yeah, some of it's got to be luck. I just happened to be born where I was to the people I was born to. That's been a big factor in, I think, in my success in my life.
Have you ever done anything in like your high school years or anything that you're like, oh, I could have gotten convicted for that?
No comment. So, sure. Yeah. I mean, of course we've all, you know,
done something stupid.
Yeah. Stupid once upon a time. Yeah, absolutely.
I definitely did. And yeah. I think back on that and go, wow, you know, that could have gone completely horribly wrong.
Yeah. Or you just, you know, things where you came really close to something bad happening and because you got lucky or maybe you made the right decision at the right time, it went a different way. But just, you know, those little tiny decisions we make in our lives, they're like little forks in the road.
And yeah.
It's not hard to go the wrong way.
What are you concerned about now falling to that point where you'd need an attorney? You think there's any time in your life right now where you're like, ooh, I could make a mistake?
For me?
Yeah. I mean, you've got kids, you're stable, you got a job, you're sure. Working in the courts anyway, right? You know law really well. But could you imagine yourself making a mistake? I guess the one that I'm concerned about is not pay attention when driving.
Yeah.
It could be
yeah.
so easy to have an accident that was your fault.
That's a huge one. And I now that my kids are old enough to really be paying attention to what I'm doing, I used to like have my phone in the cup holder.
Yeah.
But even like you get a text message, even just looking down, even if you don't pick up the phone to look at it, but you look down, you're taking your attention away for a minute. And of course, you know, we'll have mornings where we're sitting in traffic and maybe I'll like pick up my phone and see.
Because you're stopped, right?
Right, exactly. But then my kids are watching. So I want them to have their phone turned off and in the glove compartment
the
once they start driving, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You want it on because you want to be able to track where they are.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's, yeah, silent mode locked in the glove compartment.
Yeah.
So I definitely...
So you're trying to model it better.
Yeah, exactly. And when I catch myself, because I'm, you know, it's
so
these
addictive.
Phones are so, yeah, they're so... they're like an invasive species, you know, and now it's just like, it's so, I commonly will find myself holding it in my hand, looking at it like, why am I doing this? And so if I catch myself in the car, I'll even tell the kids like, hey, I apologize. I need to get better habits, you know, cause I don't want them to get in accidents or get tickets or whatever the case may be once right. they start driving.
It's interesting. You almost think of our life form as actually a human with a phone is kind of the structure we actually are now.
Yeah.
Like a parasitic life form.
What's the concept of human and machine coming together?
Cybernetics is the term.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah. We're
definitely going that way.
We're getting pretty close.
So you try, so you can see yourself having a really serious accident and being maybe at fault. I mean, I was looking, just the idea of accidentally killing somebody. You know, bicyclists on the roads out here is a really easy one to... You get close one day and you went, wow, that could have been completely catastrophic for that person, obviously, and also for my entire life.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the one part where I can see myself falling into a situation where I'm... And so I remind myself when I'm driving, don't look at the phone, you know, be really intelligent, slow down, all those things. But do you see people that whose lives have been changed by literally an accident like that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's so easy. You get into a car and they're so dangerous. We just take it for granted because that's how we get around. But yeah, absolutely.
When does like Santa Cruz County decide to prosecute somebody for manslaughter when driving?
I think anytime, unless it's, I'm trying to imagine a situation where you wouldn't, if you get into an accident and kill somebody, it would have to be pretty evidently accidental, or the person who was killed would have had to clearly be at fault to avoid getting prosecuted for manslaughter. So,
wow.
So if you're, I mean, the legal standard would be to get prosecuted for that would be criminal negligence, which is acting in willful disregard for a known
law,
a known risk.
Like looking at your cell phone while you're driving.
Oh yeah. You could definitely get
prosecuted.
That's
a perfect example. You know, that's dangerous. You did it anyway. It's illegal as fact. And therefore, criminal negligence.
Oh, yeah. And you better believe if you were to, let's say you get into an accident and somebody's killed, they're going to, you know, the law enforcement, as they investigate, they're going to take a look at your phone and they'll be able to tell, you know, did a text message just come in? Did you send something out? Was your, you know, maybe your phone still open to whatever it was open to?
Well, let's talk about cell phones. You've got a really interesting document that I think you've probably spoken to in different venues about cell phones, your rights, things of that nature. That's kind of what we're going to, the main topic of today. So, When your phone, like I think of the phone as a pretty personal thing. I've got data on it that really represents who I am, and even stuff that I wouldn't want anyone but maybe my spouse to know about, you know, bank accounts, things of that nature, obviously. Yeah. But also maybe notes that are personal thoughts of myself, maybe my calendar with my therapist, whatever it might be, a very private part of my life. And
sure.
yet a lot of that stuff is actually not even hosted on my machine. It's actually hosted at Google or Amazon or wherever my online accounts are. So let's say I make a terrible accident and somebody gets killed, and I'm one of the drivers and someone gets killed. What occurs with my phone records and things? What actually takes place?
So lots of different crimes. It's now fairly customary for your phone to be seized. Let's assume it appears as though a crime has occurred. And we can use the example of you get into an accident looking at your phone and somebody's hurt or killed. It's pretty standard for your phone to be seized as evidence. And then once it's in law enforcement's hands, there's a variety of steps they'll do to preserve whatever evidence may be there. That doesn't, just because they seize it doesn't mean that they automatically get to look at the contents of your phone.
So will they seize it and then not do anything with it until they get down further down the line?
Sometimes they'll ask you for your permission to look in your phone, and they'll ask you for your password to unlock it, and it's not information that you're obligated to give to anybody.
And what's your recommendation there?
I say always, even if it's not clear that you're being investigated, but somebody starts asking you questions wanting private information, somebody being law enforcement, my advice is remain silent, ask if you're being investigated. If they don't give you a clear answer, say you don't want to answer any questions without a lawyer. And that's really key, is indicate not only that you want to remain silent, but that you want a lawyer. Because if you just opt to remain silent, they can continue to question you. Investigators, law enforcement, they're very good at getting people to talk. And if you say
they're
that
you trained at this, right?
Exactly. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They build rapport. There's all sorts of techniques. If you say you don't want to talk and you don't want to answer any questions without a lawyer, they're actually obligated to stop questioning at that point and not resume either until you've had a lawyer or until some significant passage of time has occurred.
Now, I know if I have no funds and I'm going to go to court because of movies and stuff, I know that at that point, when I'm being prosecuted, I can get a defendant. Can I get a lawyer to talk with me, like your office to talk with me and represent and paid by the county just about that question of whether I should share this information or not?
We do some... free sort of public information. If it's somebody asking for advice particular to their case, and we're not representing them yet, they're going to have to wait until we're appointed. But I've had people retain me in advance of being prosecuted because there was, something had occurred and there was this kind of looming possibility of prosecution. And if that's, I hate to say it, but if you have the means to do something like that,
you want to get on the ball soon.
Yeah, exactly. Because a lot of times you can get information ahead of time. You can maybe even preempt charges being filed. I mean, this would be in a case where it's like low level.
For example, I might come to you and go, hey, this accident happened and they want to look at my phone, but I'm given permission. And I don't think anything's wrong with them giving that. Can I just give it to them? Because I didn't get a text message. I wasn't on the phone. And then there's kind of discussion. You might say, oh, yeah, go ahead and share it with them as soon as possible so they can end that line of questioning. Or what would you do in that situation?
I would typically say don't give permission. Let's get together and have a conversation. And I would want to know more about what other kinds of content are on your phone. And that's so the risk is perhaps you would be exonerated for the accident because there's there's no evidence that your phone was actually being used at the time of the accident.
But I have something else on my phone that's inappropriate.
Typically, what will happen if they don't get permission to have your phone unlocked and search it? They'll go get a warrant. And in the meantime, they've put your phone into these, I can't remember the name, these bags that no signal can get in or out of, so you can't remotely.
Faraday bag. Yeah.
There you go, exactly. And then once they have the search warrant, they plug your phone into, Cellbrite is one of the companies that makes a machine, but there's a couple different machines, and it does a forensic copy of all of the contents of your phone. You're talking about a tremendous volume of data.
Sure.
And it'll put it into a report that's very easy to search.
This is assuming that they have an ability to decrypt the phone. And of course, that's dependent on the phone type you have and all these things and whether they can or not. But yeah, we cover this kind of story on GeekSpeak all the time. But that stage of copying it happens after a warrant.
Yeah, otherwise unless there's some exigent circumstances, it's a search. And so there has to be some probable cause and urgency for them to do that, or they have to get a warrant.
Right. Or, of course, I could have said, yeah, go for it.
Or you gave them permission. Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of searches happen, consensually.
Yeah.
And so what I was getting to is perhaps, it would exonerate you for the accident, but maybe there's some content on there that is illegal. Maybe there's some evidence of, tax evasion. I don't know.
Something else.
The one that people that I see probably more than anything else. And it doesn't mean that it's rampant or happening a lot, but maybe they find like some child pornography or something like that. I actually had, I can't remember how they got this. It was one of my juvenile clients, and I can't remember how they ended up being interested in him, but they found that he had images that an ex-girlfriend had sent him. Well, they're both minors, and so this content is technically child pornography.
Even if he's still a minor?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can be a minor and still and be in possession of child pornography.
What if it's pictures of yourself?
That's different. I mean, you can have you can have pictures of yourself.
Of course, one of the recommendations that in this document you you shared with me is like never, ever put naked pictures on your phone of yourself or other people.
That's a good first step, because it's not only, you know, not only the criminal consequences, but you know, once you take a picture, if especially I don't really use cloud services because I'm paranoid, but most people, you just automatically, you know, you set up your Apple account and you've got your cloud account, and it just automatically going to the cloud and backing up. And it's very convenient for a lot of things.
And it loads your photos.
Right. But once you take it, you know, you take a selfie and it goes to the cloud, or you send it to one person, you know, whether it's Snapchat or whatever you're doing, it's out there, and it's every server that it's touched. And you could probably speak to this more succinctly than I can, but there's going to be some remnant of that data.
Well, it's interesting that the idea of a full copy of your entire phone and then looking at that to see if there's anything illegal on it. If you've browsed a pornography website with your phone, the images that are actually being cached to your phone are maybe ones you don't even look at, because down lower on the page, that's where the image shows up.
Right.
But there might be images you're really not interested in. And they end up having someone that's under 18 in them. That's on your phone. You're responsible for that. So there's this very interesting boundary where it wasn't even your intent necessarily.
Yeah.
But just because of ownership.
And you're absolutely right. And there is a defense in there, certainly, because like you said, you know, it could be stuff that's not even visible on the monitor you're looking at. It's a scroll down before you get to that. And but some it's preloaded, so it's, you know, and all these things.
Do you
that
get into that minutia in a court?
I have. I did a jury trial on a possession of child pornography case, and it was really interesting because it was a computer being used at the public library, one of their computers. And so we actually had the guy from the Santa Cruz Public Library who set up their server come in, because he'd kind of cobbled together is the wrong word. It sounds like it was ramshackle. He's a very smart guy, and but had built their computer system and had to explain exactly how data was stored.
With this idea that every individual user would have a cache that would be that user would be responsible for, something of that nature?
Exactly. Okay. But then they had it set up so that they didn't have to have a lot of memory, because once you logged out, it erased everything from your session. And so we had him testify. The district attorney's office had their own
expert
testify. And then I retained an expert. I'm blanking on his name right now, but he's up in Washington. And interestingly, there's not very many any geeks out there looking for some potentially lucrative work. There aren't many people who want to work with this kind of subject matter, just because obviously occasionally you're going to have to look at some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very troubling. But getting into the minutia is important, because it's not strict liability. You know, if you didn't know you were possessing something, let's say you with a situation where you're browsing a website and you're looking at legal content, but something preloads into your, whether it's your phone or your laptop or whatever, preloads down the page that you didn't actually see or select or even want, but then it's stored in your computer, and then somehow investigators find that and you're accused of possessing this material, then getting into that minutia might be exactly what prevents you from being convicted.
It's kind of equivalent to receiving a magazine in the mail that you didn't order. And then you have it for a second.
That's a great
before
analogy.
You throw it away, right? It's like you didn't really intend. It's in your junk mail pile, but there was no looking at it. That's kind of what cachings are at this point. So in that situation, I'm just always curious. It looks like in the television, like, I guess we're all really horribly informed because of these court drama cases, right? It looks to me like a prosecutor just like, it's on there. I'm attacking you. I'm going to get you. If I can get you, I'm going to get you. And there's no point at which it's like, oh, that was a mistake. I see. Never mind. I mean, it seems like at some level you want a rational actor in there as the prosecutor, even though they want a conviction of the person doing something wrong. If they're convinced along the way that, you know, it does look like it was just a cash thing, it wasn't their intent, or they're both 16, why would I care if he's got pictures of her on his phone? Like, why does it become a situation where a person just decides to prosecute someone like that?
Fortunately, I think most people who are prosecutors are pretty rational actors, and they'll look at context. And, you know, sometimes you got to, I don't mean to be an apologist for anybody, but the prosecutors who make the filing decisions, they're dealing with a huge volume of police reports. So take a step back. Every time the police have a contact where a crime is reported, typically they're going to cut a report. They're going to make some. It might be very short, and these reports get forwarded to the district attorney's office. There's occasionally they won't forward them, but for the most part, they're all getting forwarded to the district attorney's office, and the district attorney's office then has to review them and decide which ones there's grounds to actually try and prosecute somebody. Does it look like a crime was committed? And so they actually weed out quite a few, but you're talking about very high volume. And so sometimes they'll look at it and at first blush without a real in-depth look, okay, this looks like enough. Let's go ahead and file charges. The problem there is if it's, you know, the charges are child pornography or any kind of sex related crime, just the accusation itself can be incredibly damaging for people's lives. And I think with those cases, they're probably a little bit more circumspect and a little bit more.
So they might go, let's put this in the maybe pile, and then a little bit later, a few of them look at it and go, yeah, right. This looks like it's viable.
Right. And okay. So back to the document that sure. I gave you that we're talking about, that's a presentation I put together to talk to pretty much like high school age kids about the risks that they run when they use their cell phones. And so like if by happenstance, they happen to find that some 16-year-old guy has a picture of his 16-year-old girlfriend nude on his phone, that alone is very unlikely to result in a prosecution. Typically where these events end up on the radar and result in a prosecution are like the revenge porn kind of scenarios where
they break up and he
gives it to the lacrosse team or whatever it is.
Okay.
Situations like that. And then
on top of maybe another thing of like harassment or something, on top of that, they file a separate charge of just having on their phone.
Right, right. Right. And you know, if you're not doing anything else criminally suspicious in your life, and by some circumstance, law enforcement gets into the cache files on your computer and they find some image that's illegal, they're probably going to take a step back and kind of assess the situation and think like maybe this is just a situation where somebody went to a website and there was some content that was right. not legal, but it doesn't look like this person is otherwise interested in that. You know, typically
they have 30,000 pictures of children on their computer.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And the prosecutions of adult for child pornography, they actually often begin with federal investigation. It's very sophisticated the way they investigate these things because there's a lot of the illegal material, child pornography, is exchange through these, like the way people used to do file sharing for MP3.
Yeah, through news groups.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so nobody's actually, you'll share what you have on your computer with other people, and there's no, I don't, it does, I guess
no
it doesn't
server situation.
There's no server situation.
Oh, so torrents maybe, something like that.
Yeah, okay. And they're able to, they'll go on basically undercover as somebody looking to file share, and then they'll get the ISP information from the other people logged on, mm-hmm. and then get physical addresses connected to that ISP information, and then get a warrant, and they'll show up at somebody's house. They'll seize the computers and see what they can find.
I see.
And then in those,
so it's more like stings.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
A little different than you turn over your phone, and there's, you know, you're being charged for harassing someone, and therefore they look at other things as well.
Right.
So when you talk with students, you kind of talk about common trouble. We mm-hmm. talked about this idea of child pornography possibly being on your phone. You heard if you're a child, you know, if you're 16 or something and you have pictures of other kids,
yeah.
That's really a serious problem. Don't have that.
Yeah.
But what are the other things? We were talking a little bit about harassment.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's – I was just talking to my daughter. She's kind of in a text message fight with one of her friends today. And there's a couple different penal codes you can run afoul of. There's penal code section 422, which is criminal or terrorist threats. And that is making a threat with the intention to be perceived as a threat. And also the threat has to be to commit either great bodily injury or death or cause death.
Okay. And this has to be like an immediate threat, not
like
an
immediate,
not like
unequivocal. Exactly. Okay. Immediate and unequivocal.
So if I'm in a fight with a friend in a text message and I go, I'm going to beat you up or something.
Right.
I say that. Is that potentially a 422, penal code 422?
That is, yeah. I mean, I've had
even
cases where...
Even if it's potentially a joke, without knowledge of that, that would have to be assessed in court.
It would have to... It doesn't necessarily have to get to court, but somebody might take a look at it. And, you know, the issue is, did the person that got the text take it seriously enough that they're then reporting it to their parents or to law
right.
enforcement?
Right.
And you would look at the context of the other messages. Because oftentimes we say things like that and it's hyperbole, right? Sure. I'm going to kill you. I'm so mad. But the one that's much easier to run afoul of is penal code section 653M. I think it's M. There's a bunch of different subsections that cover different types of communication. And basically, it's any kind of electronic communication sent to annoy, harass, or threaten. And so if, you know, if I send you 50 messages saying, you know, I hate you, I, you know, whatever it is, clearly there's some intention for me to harass you or to annoy you. And you could be, you, it's not a felony. It's a misdemeanor, but it's still something you could potentially.
That's 653.
653. Yeah.
And this is California or?
It's a state law. Yeah. California Penal Code.
Sorry, all your international listeners. I'm sorry we're talking so much about California. I'm sure it's all of those ideas are applicable, even if the laws are different.
Oh, yeah.
The and idea of being careful digitally.
And the child pornography sting operations I was talking about, those are typically done, but those typically aren't done by local law enforcement. That'll be like an FBI investigation. We'll get them in our local courts because it might not be a big enough case for the FBI to prosecute.
Oh, and they'll hand you all the
so they'll hand it to the district attorney's office and let it be prosecuted on a county level. Yeah.
Interesting. So this idea of whether something is sent to harass and annoy or threaten someone, and kind of the intent and the perceived intent, these are all minutiae that prosecutors decide prior to prosecuting. But once that takes place, then the defense could be the intent was a joke, or here are other cases where the same thing happened back and forth and nothing came of it. So there's different ways of defending or, you know, defending this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Comment. Do you find yourself in a situation ever where you are in it, like, why is this prosecutor moving forward? This is stupid.
Sure.
Or most of the time you're like, oh, no, I get it.
I've had both scenarios happen. Very often you look at the case like, okay, I can see why they would file this. But we have to do a little more digging, or we have to develop our defense a little bit through some investigation. Occasionally I'll have cases like, what do they have? What is it about this case that made them want to file it? It seems silly to me. That's not that common, but it certainly happens. And
when that happens and you go, wait, there must be something else going on here, and you find out, oh, they've had another case with this person and they're trying to get them again. Or do you find another story and do you bring that into court?
I mean, I look at everything I can, and you might find that there's exactly, you know, they had a similar case that wasn't filed on. And so this is the second or third time of this similar kind of conduct. And so now they're kind of tired of, you know, they're not going to let it go this time.
Mm-hmm. So when you're doing that though, if you're looking at intent, district attorney, you know, they're people wanting to do good, right? That's the whole reason you get into public service is that. So is there a bit of animosity between your groups, or do you feel collegial? Do you feel at some point they're like, man, you know, Zach's just getting in our way again.
I'm sure if I'm doing my job right, hopefully that phrase is uttered very often in the district attorney's office. I get along pretty well with just about everybody in our local district attorney's office, just because, you know, it's a small county. We see these people all the time. And so I think it's important to be polite. There's definitely been cases where, you know, it's gotten heated, and, you know, I and a prosecutor have been angry at each other. You know, usually with the passage of time, those things will go by. But it's, you know, it's an adversarial setting.
Why does it have to be adversarial?
I guess it doesn't have to be, and we often negotiate resolutions. But I mean, the process is set up to be adversarial. You have one party who makes an allegation, and you have to, you know, the defendant has to defend against that. And so, you know, you're kind of in building, and what you're building up towards is either some kind of, I guess, negotiated resolution where somebody admits to something and you have a plea bargain, or a trial.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trial is one party's trying to prove something, the other party's trying to prevent them from proving it and perhaps prove something differently. And it comes down to ultimately the jury picking a winner and a loser. And so it's, I guess there's the adversarial aspect of it is, until we rewrite the Constitution and come up with some new process,
no, I think
inevitable.
It's baked in. I mean, it's kind of the boundary of where you have a society that you agreed upon, right? It's when the law gets broken, and then you do have an adversarial. You have this idea of what kind of society you want versus when it's okay to break it, and that boundary has to be defined by somebody. You spoke earlier about, no, these aren't the other. These are just also people.
Yeah.
Are you always able to hold that kind of level of emotional connection with people, or at some point you're like, wow, this person is just horrible abuse. Like, I don't want to deal with this person, but I'm representing them.
Sure. I pride myself on having had the ability, I think, in just about every case I've worked on, to find some modicum of humanity in everybody I've dealt with. Okay. And I mean, that's in the context of having worked on some cases with
really?
Individuals who've done some very, bad's too, not the right adjective, but you know, very,
Right. Already convicted of something horrible, horrible, and now you're on a second case and you're trying to defend them. And or, so you're like,
Yeah. I mean, the conduct, you know, and well, sometimes, you know, even if there's a defense, it doesn't mean that the conduct is all good necessarily. Yeah. So, you know, I've dealt with some people who've done some very bad things. So I'll just use the word bad.
And how do you do that? How do you keep a human connection with them? How do you cultivate that without feeling bad about yourself?
I mean, I think I can recognize the good aspects in somebody who's done something really bad without me being a bad person. And if anything else, it maybe I think it makes me more human, being able to kind of peel back the layers. Uh-huh. And it doesn't mean, and just because I can recognize the humanity in somebody doesn't mean I condone everything that they've done. You know, I think we all know probably somebody in our life who has done bad things, but we still have some affinity for them.
Yeah, they're called family.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, really, it's, you know, there's, if you go through all the people you've ever known, somebody's done something wrong. And just because you care about them in spite of that doesn't mean that you're saying their conduct is...
And at some level, we all have flaws, right? There's nobody perfect.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? So it's, okay. Well, that I think that's kind of a... I guess that's a really important step in doing what you do, because you do have to represent their best interests. Mm-hmm. That's your job.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like you've gotten somebody off from, you know, a crime they clearly did commit, but because of technicality, that you won? That you regretted?
No, I don't. I haven't regret. I mean, I've definitely, you know, I've advocated for people who I disagree. I'm not a fan of the things they've done. But I also believe, you know, my job is in this system where we're not, you know, a guilty or not guilty verdict is not saying good conduct or bad conduct. It's saying, did this person do something that it's now okay for the government to step in and restrict their liberty in some, you know, maybe minor or maybe very, very serious way. And if you take a step back and look at that, like the concept of the government stepping in and saying, you don't get to live where you want anymore. You're going to live in this jail, or you have to pay these fines. It's very extreme, right? It doesn't mean I don't agree with that being the right way to deal with things, but that's an extreme thing. We're taking away somebody's freedom. And to me, I value liberty. I value freedom. And if we're going to allow the government to take those steps and it dole out those punishments, then we should have a high standard. It should be a high burden of proof, and the process should be fair. And it's worth it to go through it to make sure that we're not, you know, wrongly taking liberty away from people.
Yeah. Okay. So you recommend to students, you kind of tell kids in general, careful about harassment and threats and careful about, you know, drinking, drugs and gangs and child pornography, we already talked about.
Sure.
But talk about the drinking, drugs, and gangs. Is it possible for, you know, the phone to be seized and be searched because of some looking for something and then see pictures of some underage kids drinking at a party?
They in those cases where that's an issue in the cases I've worked on, they didn't even need to seize their phone. You know, they can just go onto social media and see, you know, somebody posted something on Instagram, somebody posted something on YouTube, or whatever
just
the
publicly.
Medium is. Oh yeah. You know, the most common scenario I have is I'll have clients that are on probation, and the terms of their probation are no drugs or alcohol, or don't hang out with people that are
having drugs
and
alcohol.
Yeah, or don't hang out with people that are known to be gang members, or don't wear gang paraphernalia.
And they've promised to do that because part of the probation.
Exactly.
Was that,
so yeah, that's the agreement. As a part of your probation, you have to follow these rules.
The probation officer just follows them on Instagram and goes,
exactly.
There's a problem.
Yeah, I've walked into court and they've walked. You know, I've had a probation officer walk up and hand me some pictures they just printed off of. It probably wasn't Facebook. None of the young kids use Facebook anymore, but hand me some pictures they got off the internet. And here's your client, and he's got, you know, this like a common. Thing that Norteños in Watsonville wears Washington Nationals hats, like the red Washington Nationals hat. And, you know, here's a picture of my client wearing that hat, and he's drinking a beer at, you know, it's like somebody's backyard.
Wait, and that party. Hat represents a gang in Watsonville or something?
Yeah. So very generally speaking, Norteños, so one of the, there's a, Norteños is kind of like, you can go back to the origins of the gangs are in state prisons, but at street level, there's Norteños and there's different subsets of Norteño. And typically red and the number 14 are associated with Norteño gangs. And so if you're on probation and one of your terms is gang terms, which you can't be a part of a gang, you can't hang out with gang members, and you can't wear gang paraphernalia.
Part of the liberty that's been taken away from you because of the conviction.
Exactly. Okay. And you're wearing a, you know, bright red Washington Nationals hat. And this is typically, it's unique to Watsonville, because Watsonville, the W, Washington Nationals have the W.
Okay.
There's also, I mean, there's, you know, you would be amazed at what has been categorized as gang paraphernalia, but
Yeah, it seems like sportswear. I mean, I wouldn't know that that was gang paraphernalia.
Right.
So who is it? Who? What group is it talking to? And why is it offensive to the state for a person on probation to have sports paraphernalia that matches gang? Like, how, where does that decision get drawn?
It's often very murky.
Yeah.
You know, if you it has to be in a context. You know, the reality is there probably aren't that many Washington Nationals fans in California.
What sport is that, by the way?
Baseball. It's okay, a baseball thanks. Team. Yeah.
I don't know sports. I'm like, I don't even know.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes it's not clear. And what I tell my clients who end up on probation with those terms is don't take any chances. And if you're not sure about something, don't wear it, or call your probation officer and ask if it's okay to wear it.
I would think the picture of them drinking a beer too is I mean, they're of course not.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And all these things, of course, you can argue, right? Like, no, my mom's a big Washington National fan. We went as a kid, and I mean, there's a debate there of whether you're going to fight that or not.
Sure.
And if they're going to be, so do you decide whether you defend on that or not?
It's always so. The choices that anybody, whether it's a juvenile in juvenile court or an adult in adult criminal court, the decision on whether you plead guilty or not is always the defendant's, the person being charged. I'll give them my opinion. And sometimes, you know, it's real clear, like, you know, here's this plea bargain being offered to you. There's no way you're going to do better at trial. You should take this deal. Sometimes the plea bargain is garbage, and I'll tell them, let's go to trial. It's worth fighting. Or we have a clear defense and we should fight it. And then very often there's also just kind of, it's pretty close. Like, mm-hmm. maybe if we did fight it, it could get a little bit better, but you're risking X, Y, and Z. And so it's a conversation we have, and I educate them as much as I can. And, make suggestions where it's appropriate, but it's ultimately always up to the person to decide.
When you've confiscated a phone because of some mm-hmm. incident and they want to get into it, and so they ask a judge says, yep, and you get a warrant to search the phone. You get contents of the phone, depending on security and lockdown, all that stuff, depending on how that's being done, you could technically get that. But you can also get cell company data.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a standard thing?
They'll subpoena records from your cell provider.
And the cell provider will give phone numbers, calls in and out, missed calls, all that, just like on your bill. Mm-hmm. Will it also provide data location information?
Oh, yeah. You'll get cell tower information.
For every, for like tracking data? Like
basically what you'll get is like a giant Excel spreadsheet, and it's got, you know, ingoing and outgoing messages and calls, who sent it, who it was to. There's all these different, you get a legend explaining all these different codes, but they know whether or not somebody answered the call. They know whether or not it went to voicemail. They can tell whether or not or how long the call was for. And then you'll get to a section where it actually has, it'll identify the cell towers.
For those calls or for all cell phones the phone was seen in?
It'll be specific to the calls. So you'll okay. have like, it's basically like a timestamp with the caller, call. The party information, and the location and the cell towers used.
The question I have is, if I haven't received ingoing, outgoing, but I am transferring around, driving around, whatever, in different points, are all those getting logged or is it only when transformation happens? Because it seems like there'd be a lot of data in that situation if you travel a lot. You'd have like all these cell phones.
It's only when you're making a call or a message where you're going to get information about the cell tower being used. So, because okay. I guess our phones are always
they're always
pinging, right?
But there's no reason to log that. I guess
normally. I guess I'm not. Yeah, I mean, I'm not. I'm certainly not an expert in that, so I don't know if it would be logging. But certainly when there's calls and messages, and I've had cases where people were. Their location at the scene of a crime was proven using cell towers. And yeah. I've had cases where clients were exonerated because the cell tower location put them somewhere else.
Totally or at least their different. Phone somewhere else.
Yeah, their phone yeah. somewhere else, exactly.
Okay, so that we're talking about all the data that's collected by the individual who's being prosecuted. What about the data on other people? Like, and I'm thinking, have you seen a situation where it's more of a sting situation where the police officer had asked an informant to put something on their phone and now there's a recording of a conversation or there's tracking information because there's more software on the phone that's keeping track of things? Do you see that kind of stuff too, where it's more of a forward-thinking, advanced sting operation? Or is that more larger cases?
I've had cases that probably is more common in like a federal, like longer term investigation. But I've had cases where somebody was getting, as they were getting arrested for on suspicion of drug sales, they're getting text messages from people wanting to buy drugs. And the police then pose as the person who they're contacting and then make subsequent arrests.
Just coincidental.
It was just bad luck for the people. Good luck, I guess, for the investigators. Bad luck for the people on the other side of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you get these, so after they do the cell phone downloads, when I'm working on a case, they have to give me that information through discovery.
And how they give it to you? They print it for you?
They'll give me a thumb drive.
Okay, that's nice.
And yeah, I think, and well, I don't even know how it would print, because the way that they design the software, it's really meant to be used electronically, because it's
a massive amount of data,
huge amounts, and it's all searchable. But you get this really nice, depending on, there's a few different companies that make the software, but all of them have this very nice, first page interface where it's all of the categories of content on your left hand side of the screen. And it's messages, videos, internet activity, you name it, anything sure. You do, it's there. All your applications and the data related to that. And then you can go on that, you can search, and you can see, this person was at this time was downloading this video, and very often the video will still be there. Or if the video isn't there, you can, you'll be able to get a
URL for it.
URL, exactly. And go and get that information. And so everything you do, we're as we use our phones, we are collecting an absurd amount of data about ourselves. And it may be things that are totally innocuous. It may be information that we do not want people to ever be aware of.
You mentioned earlier that you're kind of paranoid about cloud services, so you don't use them. Is that paranoia come from, just something psychologically wrong with you as a child, or because of your work?
I think it's from reading 1984. I don't want Big Brother watching me. I mean, I don't have anything to hide, but I just don't like the idea of that information being out there. And I also took a course in law school, and it was there's this whole mechanism to file actions against the credit reporting companies because
they've messed up so badly.
They've messed up so badly. And there's people who have these horrible marks on their credit ratings because the credit reporting agencies, I don't know, I'm not up to speed on the state of things now, but when I took this class, they would match your, how many digits are in a Social Security form?
Nine
digits, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So they would match the first seven and your name, and that was close enough. Well, you'd be surprised how many Lyle Troxels are out in the world with the
maybe
same
not
first...
Lyle Troxel, but definitely John Smiths.
Oh yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Some are very common, and and it's, I guess it saved them a little bit of time not going to nine digits for the match.
Right.
But some
people... even at nine digits, we have 300 million people in the United States, so mm-hmm. nine digit number is not big enough.
Right.
Like it's just that's how it works.
Yeah.
So we reuse them, and also some are not appropriate. Like you can't have leading zeros on all the numbers. So there's lots of issues. There's duplications of Social Security numbers. So you're saying there's records for people that are totally misaligned.
Oh yeah. So somebody goes to try and get a loan to buy a house, and like, oh no, you owe $30,000 on this
that's
lien.
It's a lot of money to figure out.
Yeah. You're like, wait, what? And so anyways, that just has. I've just always kind of been wary of where my information is going and who can get their hands on it.
So do you not partake in these cloud services because of that or other things?
That's primarily it. And I've definitely gotten to a point where like I lost a phone and it would have been so nice to have everything backed up on the cloud. But I don't know. I guess I'm a bit of a troglodyte.
Well, it's funny because I see I'm a, kind of a, I care about justice. I think about some of these scenarios that you're chatting about as being pretty ridiculous. And I know technical solutions that would solve those problems. You could have a piece of hardware at your home that would back up your phone mm-hmm. and it wouldn't be in the cloud and it would have a complete backup so that when you did drop it in the lake, you could just download it again. But there's no financial reason for that to exist. Apple or Google don't really need that it's a lot easier to have it on their cloud services. Right. And so it becomes a situation where it's just more convenient to do it that way.
Yeah.
Are you an Apple or an Android person?
I've slowly become an Apple person.
Okay. So with Apple, you can download the phone to your laptop through iTunes.
And I have, I've gotten better about backing.
Yeah, that's
gotten better about backing
up. Once you've lost photos, you realize that's the way to go if you're going to manage it yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah, our footprint is kind of massive. The other thing that's interesting to me is that with my phone, I can easily lock it, permanently brick it with just holding a couple buttons because you can do that with an Apple device. I'm assuming that that's not always the case of what happens when someone gets arrested. They don't think to do that with their phone.
I don't think they automatically expect that their phone's going to be used. I think most people are totally ignorant about how much information they're collecting about themselves.
Yeah, until they get to court and they're like, no, you were there.
Right, yeah. And really, most people aren't using their phones to commit crimes. And probably the most common way that this stuff comes up is exactly like putting people at locations at times, or if it's a crime that might have... require some demonstration of planning ahead of time. There might be communications that suggest that the crime was going to happen.
Right.
The easy one is like drug sales. Like you know, that you'll look for. It's very seldom like, hey, I want to buy some drugs from you, but there's code words that are commonly used in that
and sphere. And when you say commonly used, how does that get proven in court? Someone says, yeah, I'm a drug user and I use that word for whatever.
It's typically through the testimony of an expert law enforcement witness. So they'll bring in somebody who did undercover and actually engaged in drug transactions as an undercover officer. And I know if somebody says a 20, they're referring to this. And if, you know, I'm blanking on the different types of slang that can be used, but anything you can imagine. And it changes from time to time.
Right. Like what kind of baseball hats represent you in a gang.
Exactly. Like I learned a while ago, if they refer to drugs being stepped on, it means that they're somebody had like some pure or higher concentration like heroin, and then they've stepped on it, so they cut it down with something else.
Yeah. Okay,
that's one example.
All right, so your five recommendations for dealing with police when you're being arrested or detained or investigated. Mm-hmm. Your rights and responsibilities. Know your rights and responsibilities. Recently, I got into watching just insane recorded cams of people arguing with police officers. Uh-huh. Your last recommendation is to be polite.
Yes.
And I would say that was your first, that's the first recommendation. It feels like it's so easy for those things to escalate out of bad situations.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one person feels righteous and like, I didn't do anything wrong, and you're just stopping me for some other reason. And just right away, you have an antagonistic relationship with someone.
Right.
And both of you have that kind of fight with you. It's just going to get worse and worse, and eventually one of you has a gun and the other doesn't. So
that's kind of what I mean. What, you know, let's say hypothetically you feel like you're being mistreated by law enforcement. You can get as mad as you want. They're going to win at the end of the situation. And so the best, that's why I say be polite, because and often, you know, I think being polite has gotten me out of tickets before. You know, I can't remember where I read the best thing to do when you get pulled over, like driving your car, let's say a CHP officer pulls you over, it was keep your seatbelt on. Turn on the dome light so that it lets the officers
see. If it's nighttime.
Yeah, exactly. So they have a clear view of what's in the vehicle, and keep your hands at, you know, 10 and 2 on the wheel. And all of this is going to potentially put the officer at ease as they approach, because, you know, they don't know what they're walking into.
Right.
And 9 times out of 10, they're walking into, you know, just some guy on the way home from work.
Yeah.
But they don't know. They've dealt with, and they've been trained to expect really horrible things. And so if you can put them at ease, it's going to affect how they approach you, I think. And then if you're polite, and you can assert your rights. I'm not saying don't, you know, assert your rights and be free, but you can do it politely. You can ask, you know, am I under arrest? And if they say no, then you can ask, well, then am I free to go? And if they, you know, if you're asked questions that you don't want to answer, you can say, I don't care to answer any questions. Thank you. And you're saying no, but you're not escalating the situation. Mm-hmm. You're not giving them some reason to keep giving you a hard time.
So if I'm pulled, if something happens in my life and I'm engaging with a police officer and I say, you know, they say to me, hey, where are you going? Or can I look in your car? Tell me, you know, who are you seeing tonight? Have you had anything to drink? Or all these questions start coming at me. If I right away do kind of what you're recommending, I'm not helping their job out. I'm sure. Stopping them from investigating. They might not be investigating me. They might want to just come to a conclusion. They might be after someone that has the same look as me or some real problems occurring. And the sooner I can help them resolve the situation, the better it will be for society in general.
Mm-hmm.
Or should I be thinking about myself because they might decide to prosecute me unintentionally or because I match the profile, whatever. Like, where is the line where you just say no? Are you recommending always just give no information and say no to everything?
That's my default, you know. You,
but that's because you're dealing with people that have been prosecuted,
exactly.
Right? I mean, I'm assuming lots of times the person just wants to know, you know, they're trying to get help from you to solve a problem.
And that could absolutely be the case. And you have to, you know, you just kind of have to use your best judgment and assess it. My legal advice, if you're asking me as a lawyer, would be remain silent and call me.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk and figure out what you want to do. But like you said, you know, and I you hear people say, well, in the context of discussions about illegal searches, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to hide. That's not the point, right? We are entitled to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. We're entitled to be free from incriminating ourselves.
The whole argument about secrecy and such has that same one.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a difference between secrecy and privacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not a secret what we do in the bathroom, but it's private.
Yeah.
And it's okay that's private and not a secret. There's a human quality of being. It's like appreciating going on a walk and being by yourself, right? Appreciating quiet. Yeah, you can always be around people, and yeah, you can be around loud environments, but it's not necessarily a healthy human that's always in that gauge in that way.
Right.
So it's just a part of a quality of who we are.
And we don't, you know, it's very seldom that you walk around and say, I really appreciate my liberty at this moment, that I can, you know, I could go to that town over there and I could get an ice cream cone because I'm free to move about. It's not until that liberty is challenged that we really think about it. Well, I have the benefit in my line of work to think about liberty all the time.
Yeah.
And so I enjoy it for its own sake. And I think that there's nothing wrong as a person living in a free society to be conscious of that. And, you know, if somebody asks me a question that I don't want to answer, even if there's no logical reason for me not to want to answer it other than I just don't want to, that's okay. And you can say, I don't care to answer that question. Thank you.
So the feeling of power from a police officer and the feeling of being under the gun, you know, being pulled over, whatever the question is, this idea that they are a representation of force over society, you know, the point of force that enforces us to be the legal way of we are in society. So there's this power situation right there, and it feels weird, and you get kind of like this odd space. What you're suggesting is that kind of represents your liberty, that those qualities are not necessarily a bad thing, to be almost offensive about that, but do it politely and respect the person and all those things.
Sure. Well, if you get unpolite, then you might end up getting arrested when you don't need to get arrested. And even if, like I said, people get arrested and it's not necessarily a lawful arrest, they still went through getting arrested and their car impounded and going to the jail or what all these things.
Yeah, and your whole day's ruined and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you can you can assert your rights, but you can also avoid escalating things into a situation that, whether it's right or wrong, you're still going to have to deal with.
All right. So you remain silent, don't consent to searches, and lying is worse than silence.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that one.
Well, a lot of times you'll get a case where there's a report and the person arrested said a bunch of information, and none of the information's true. And they actually, if they had been honest, they actually had a defense to what they're being prosecuted for. But then you're in a situation where, okay, we're going to go to trial and you're going to testify that, you know, the reality of the situation is you found this purse on the ground and you're on your way to return it. But, you actually lied about even knowing the purse was there when you talked to the police because you got nervous. So when you go to testify to the jury, you know, oh, I found this purse, I looked up the address, I was driving to this person's house to return it. Well, then you're going to get confronted with this other statement that you made that was, you said you didn't know the purse was, you know, sitting in the front seat of your car. And so you're not testifying from a position of veracity.
Right.
Whereas if you had just remained silent, I mean, and this might be a case where, you know, the logical thing might have been at the beginning, I found this purse on the ground. I looked inside. I found the address. I'm on my way there. And the officer could see that you're clearly on a route to that destination. But going back to my hypothetical, if you had just remained silent and then you get on the stand and say, you know, yeah, I found this purse. I was on my way to return it. And it's, you actually can't be, you can't use the fact that you've remained silent against you. That can't be used to incriminate you.
Right.
So you're in a much.
So don't lie.
Just don't lie. If you don't, either say nothing at all, but definitely don't lie.
All right, and stay calm.
And stay calm.
Be polite. Okay, let's move on to you're running for a judge.
Yes.
Why are judges elected here in Santa Cruz County?
They're not always. They're actually more commonly appointed by the governor. And so once you've been an attorney for 10 years, you're eligible to apply for appointment or to run if an election happens. The reason this seat is going up for election is because Jeff Almquist, who's retiring, is letting their six-year terms. And even if you're appointed, you have to run each 6 years. And so Jeff Almquist, he's going to retire, but not until the end of his term. So that's the mechanism we have in California is that triggers it going to election rather than appointment.
Why do you want to be a judge?
I want to be a judge. I want to serve Santa Cruz County. I've had a great life. I've had a great experience here. My family's growing up here. My wife and I are both from Santa Cruz County. And working as a public defender for over 10 years, I have a skill set and a familiarity with our local court system. It is a seat in our local superior court. And I feel that, you know, not only do I want to serve, but I also, because of the work I've done, I have the skill set where I can go and I could step into the role of judge, I think tomorrow, and do it effectively and efficiently and fairly. And having worked in that frontline environment of the trial courtroom and done, you know, all kinds of litigation, having done trials, having been through the pressure and oftentimes the chaos of that environment, because it can be chaotic. You get, you know, criminal court, you have people on drugs, you have people with mental illness coming in, you know, family court, you're talking about people coming in, going through divorces, all sorts of venom in the relationship. And so I've been through the crucible and I've been successful working there. And so now I can use these skills to give something back.
I'm assuming you've worked with Jeff and other judges.
Yes.
In the area.
Yeah.
Is it common for other judges and other people to recommend and to kind of endorse?
So judges actually aren't allowed to endorse candidates except for candidates for judge.
For their own position. Okay.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be. So I'm endorsed by a couple seated and retired judges in addition to Jeff Holmquist.
Jeff's endorsed you?
He has, yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was very nice.
Are you running, is there another competition for the position?
I'm running against a woman named Saida Cogliotti.
And is she a prosecutor or
she
a defendant?
Currently works as an attorney for the 6th District Court of Appeals. So things that are appealed out of our local superior court would go to that court.
And she's an attorney.
Right. She does research for one of the justices.
Does she work in this area right now?
No, that's in San Jose.
Okay.
She has worked in Santa Cruz County previously.
So we talked earlier about technical expertise and where that occurs. And I followed some people that are pretty high technical expertise that have done on podcasts and stuff. I follow, you know, pay attention to their work. And they've done work for courts.
Okay.
And the way that it feels like, the idea that I've gotten from them is that the truth of the matter has become very much less interesting than the solving the case that's going on. And the actual knowledge and understanding doesn't get spread very well. And it feels a little bit like going there, getting paid, but not really representing a good quality truth. Hmm. And also, especially if you feel like, you know, you're helping something, you're causing more problems than, so that it feels to me like my general idea of what that role is, doesn't feel very fulfilling. What are the people that are expert testimony people? They're not in law, you know, not police officers and stuff, but actually pulled in expertise. What qualities about them make them good at that? And why do you think it's rewarding for them?
So what quality makes a good non-law enforcement expert?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you just want intelligent people that have integrity in the work that they do. I think that's going to make them good at what they do. Because there's definitely some hacks out there that will do what, you know, what they're paid to do. But ultimately, you know, you can only do that for so long, you know, and somebody at some point is going to make book on you and start pointing out the inconsistencies in what you're doing.
Have you ever attacked an expert that was against you to say, you know, this person does this kind of stuff all the time and it's not right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a variety of different ways you can go at experts. And luckily, the United States Department of Justice did some review of a lot of different areas of technical expertise, fingerprints, bite marks, tool marks, DNA, and things like that.
And gave recommendations?
Gave recommendations for what can be done at every level from federal down to state, you know, county level. And they really did a very great job of looking at things like confirmation bias and different factors that can influence what otherwise looks like a scientific outcome.
Yeah.
Like you do with, let's say, for example, fingerprinting. The people doing the fingerprint analysis, if you're doing it correctly now, don't have any case background. They don't know whether or not the person who reviewed it before them found a match or not.
Because they're getting completely neutral pictures and just like, tell us what you think of these pictures.
As neutral as you can. Uh-huh. And so that's great. And so back to your question of what makes somebody a good expert is, again, it's somebody who is... There are some areas of expertise that are still used that are not particularly scientific, but to the extent that they're scientific, people who are good at what they do, who are humble enough to be open to the possibility of making mistakes and will review their work with that in mind, and who, you know, people do the things they do with coming from whatever experience they've had, and there's certainly people who may have an agenda doing that kind of work out mm-hmm. there, and I think that's something that you have to watch out for.
Yeah.
So hopefully people who are kind of neutral. And so why is it fulfilling? I think that, I don't know, I just went to a fingerprint training put on by a local expert named Lauren Zeffro. She's a PhD. She's an incredibly smart woman. Does a lot of work for law enforcement, but doesn't view herself, and I hope she wouldn't object to me kind of paraphrasing what she said. She doesn't view herself necessarily as a law enforcement expert. she views herself as an expert in this particular area, mm-hmm. this particular field, and she wants to do good work to help, you know, whatever the ends of truth and the ends of justice.
Sure.
And so I think that if take it for her, I think taking that approach is probably very fulfilling because she knows that she's doing work with integrity, that people who are not guilty are not going to be accused because of the work she's doing, and that people who have done something wrong are going to be held accountable to the extent she's able to help that out.
Yeah. Okay, so one case that we're going to talk about real quickly is Tesla recently settled an autopilot class action lawsuit with a Model S and Model X owners. Do you own a Tesla?
I don't.
Okay, good. So we can talk about this. So Tesla basically sells their vehicles, and they also sell a autopilot feature. And the autopilot feature is a $5,000 add-on cost. And the class action lawsuit was basically, hey, you charge us for this, but it took a long time before we got the feature. And when we got the feature, it wasn't very good. So they just lost the suit, and the reprobation, the payment back is to each person that had a 2016-2017 that paid for this feature can get $20 to $280 back from the class action lawsuit. The feature was $5,000. The car is more than $100,000. So why are class action lawsuits just always kind of ridiculous like this? I mean, obviously it punishes the company because they have to pay a lot of money.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Some of them are. I mean, how many times have you gotten those notices in the mail? You're entitled to $17.38 as a member of this class. So sometimes they are kind of ridiculous. I think very often class action suits are more about correcting behavior than necessarily making people whole. And the unfortunate reality of a lot of personal injury, or this would, I guess class action typically falls within personal injury, and this would be financial injury, is that once you factor in attorney fees and costs of litigation, the people who are hurt very seldom are made whole.
Right.
And you know, this can be segued into a good argument for in favor of universal healthcare and things like that. But anyways, so yeah, I think class actions can be very effective in terms of correcting, especially bad corporate behavior, but correcting behavior.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's like one of those things, if you participate, you're probably doing good for society, but you're not really necessarily benefiting. And as long as I feel like people are in their motivation for that purpose, it makes sense. I was involved in one class action lawsuit, and that was basically in the .com era. Mm-hmm. The company I was working for fell, you know, went out of business, bankruptcy, and the employees had all had back pay due, and lots of back pay, I had like 3 months of back pay due. And so we sued, I think Viacom was the company that actually was the funder of that startup.
Okay.
And so they'd been paying a lot, and they'd, I guess there was an idea of that they had a promise to pay. Anyway, it got settled. We all got some money back. It was a small percentage, of course. It was 10 years later that I saw anything. It didn't affect my life at all. But Viacom's a giant corporation. And anytime I'm going to apply for any business that was owned under Viacom, there's always that thing in there. I did take them to court once. And I guess from a clean perspective, like I don't know if I care that much to engage myself and kind of mark myself that way. I did it at the time, of course, because it was pretty serious money.
Yeah.
So in a situation like this, of the people that have, you know, sued Tesla and were part of this class action, I can imagine Tesla not offering their vehicles to these people again.
Maybe, especially with Tesla, because what's the waiting list, and you know, but that's, you know, that's the market giving them a lot of power too.
Okay, I think this case is a little bit more interesting. We covered this a while ago, and basically, do you hear the term of swatting somebody? Digital? Okay, so the general idea is two people get an argument online about something. In this situation, I think it was about gaming.
Of course.
And the defendant, who has actually just got indicted for this, and that's the case now, is that now it's there's an indictment against him for manslaughter. He found out where the person lived that he was having a fight with, and he called the local police department on them and said, this guy has a hostage in his house, he has guns, he's been shooting his guns.
Oh my God.
The SWAT team came, the guy was surprised, the SWAT team killed him.
Oh my God.
Yeah, really horrible. And all of this is documented in the game. There's documentation of like the dispute and the fight and more documentation. So the thing that I think find is fascinating, of course, this person had intent, bad intent.
Right.
He was a bad actor, right? He intended for harm for this person. And I can definitely imagine prosecuting. Like, I get that, and I think it makes sense, the indictment and everything. But the thing that's fascinating about this is that calling the police can be a life-threatening thing.
Yeah.
Which seems very weird to me, that when you call someone that theoretically their job is to help, you can actually be intending to kill somebody with them. What's wrong with our police force if that's a reality?
That's a really interesting perspective to take on it, is, yeah, what's going on where you could send the police to somebody's house and I guess it's always a possible outcome that somebody could get hurt, but it sounds like it was this guy's directive to have this guy hurt or killed. And I mean, that's a big discussion. Does it come from, you know, I'm sure you've heard of like the militarization of local police.
Yeah, right. They get hand-me-down weapons and stuff from the military. And
a lot of that is, you know, they get federal funding if they agree to. I mean, there's a lot of it was like post 9/11, like local law enforcement was able to get federal money if they agreed to do certain trainings, if they agreed to carry certain equipment. And all of it is like paramilitary training, paramilitary equipment. And if you take from one perspective, like, well, yeah, it's more training for our police. That's
and if
great.
There was a terrorist attack in the area and you have a local police force that has that kind of training and weapon, it makes sense, right?
Sure.
Totally.
But
want that.
But how do you then get the officers who've gone through that training and been trained, you know, when you approach this situation, it's potentially somebody is ready to kill you, when that's a very uncommon situation.
Oh, of course.
But that's now a part of their perspective, and that's a part of their experience. And so they go into these situations with that possibility in mind. And, you know, police officers, they want to survive. They want to go home at the end of the night.
Absolutely.
But yeah, definitely, this is a great case for us to kind of reflect as a society. Like, what do we want our police forces to be? And what do we want the makeup to be? And
it's also like every one of these SWAT teams that are trained should also be trained that this can be a thing that happens, right? It's possible for that to be the problem, right? So maybe the thing to do before you, if you get a call from out of county or whatever, or even if it looks like it's local, you go talk to a neighbor. Has there ever been gunfire here? You know, kind of get an assessment before you break down the door. But it's really interesting problem, of course. You know, that person that got upset and called the police on them, all they did was make a phone call.
Yeah.
They didn't carry a weapon. They didn't, you know, do any of these things that actually caused the death except for initiate it. And they initiate it with our police force. Fascinating problem. And I see that kind of thing occurring more, especially because, you know, I don't know if anyone's been online and not gotten angry at one point.
Oh my God.
It's so easy. In my youth, I got really irate with emails and, you know, messaging. Now when I see an engagement that looks like I'm going to have a fight about it, I'm like, I'd rather do that at a dinner party. If it's really that important, I'd rather sit down with somebody. Doing that online just doesn't feel compelling to me.
Yeah. Texting is so antisocial because when you say something mean to somebody through text, or it could be email or whatever, non-face-to-face communication, you get to feel all of like those exciting and satisfying sensations of being mean to somebody. If you say it to their face, you get those sensations, but then you also see the person's reaction, and whether it's anger or sadness or getting, you know, punched in the mouth, there's that balance there.
Right. In person contact,
exactly.
We actually viscerally have a problem with being mean because you have a human there and you relate to them.
There's a consequence.
But through the technical lens, it's easier to do.
Right. And so, you know, and exactly. Like, one of the things in my presentation I tell these kids is, like, if you're going to send something that's mean, or you're sending it as you're upset through email or text or message or whatever, if you're really upset, go ahead and write it, but don't send it. Like, close the app. Come back to it tomorrow and see if you still feel that way, because
you could totally
prevent something really nasty from happening.
It's amazing what like 6 hours will do.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You can be angry.
Ten minutes.
Yeah. And writing it out, like really writing it out. So you express how you were feeling and stuff. And then later looking at those words as not your emotional state, where they're just somebody's written words, happened to be yours, but it was a person that you were before. It's easy to let go of that at that point.
Yeah.
I highly, any kind of intense conversational email or whatever, give yourself 24 hours. And you're saying even 10 minutes? Yeah, sure. At least 10 minutes.
Some buffer. I've occasionally had situations where, you know, something started as email and I read it and it rubbed me the wrong way. And rather than, I'll write a response, but instead of that, I like to pick up the phone and just call somebody.
What was your intent with that message? Because that's what I got.
Here's how it made me feel when I read it. And I want to give you the benefit of the doubt. Yeah. That's not what you meant, or I don't know. At least, and even not face to face, but you, when you speak to people, you get the inflection, you get the tone of voice. It just, there's so much more information that we as human beings get to process and can inform how we respond.
Yeah.
So,
well, like, what do you think we're doing right now with prosecuting and such versus what we're doing wrong?
What are we doing right? I think, you know, it's probably case by case. It comes down to, you know, each individual prosecutor making decisions. But I think that socially, I think with the whole Me Too movement, we're having a great conversation about how do we create environments where women, I mean, it's typically women, but anybody who's the victim of sexual abuse or harassment can feel like they have, it's safe for them to come and air that out. So I think that's good. What else do I think we're doing right? I think that, you know, California is dealing with this whole Prop 47, Prop 57, I call it the post-realignment era. And so these are propositions that came down that decriminalize certain activities. So simple drug possession is no longer, you can't be prosecuted for a felony for it. It's just a misdemeanor. Certain theft type crimes, the value of the theft has to be higher before it can be a felony. And I say that, I'm not saying this is good because I think that crime is okay. I think that it reflects a larger shift in our society where we are, instead of viewing these lower level crimes that are often connected to poverty, drug addiction, and mental illness, instead of approaching them from a law enforcement perspective, which has gotten us
big jails.
Big jails, exactly. And extremely expensive jails. We're now saying, let's approach this from a public health perspective. Let's increase our capacity for drug rehabilitation. Let's increase our capacity for effective mental health care. Let's address poverty. And there's a nexus between all of these things. And so I think something that's great about this era that we're in is we're saying these are public health issues. These are not law enforcement issues. The challenge that we're faced with is law enforcement is used to the old system, but their tools have been taken away. And society is used to the old system where they could call and say, hey, there's some guy, you know, using drugs in front of my business. I want him dealt with. And he'd be, you know, locked up over the weekend or something. And the problem would be at least deferred for a little bit. Well, the realignment has resulted in police officers not having the same powers that they had before. Mm-hmm. And it's resulted in people in the community not being able to rely upon the police officers to address those problems in the moment. So we need to make sure that we do, in fact, build up our drug treatment capacity and do, in fact, build up our mental health treatment capacity.
Because without that, we haven't solved the problem.
Exactly. The problem's right there. And we had a solution, may not be, we had an approach that was effective at least moving the problem somewhere else previously. And now we don't have either. So we need to make sure we bring in some new tools to deal with the problem.
Did either of those measures actually bring in resources, shift the resources away from prisons into mental health? Or
not for Santa Cruz County. We applied, our county applied, and did not get the resources. So we haven't gotten any of that. And that was one of the promises, is that we'll lower the prison population, money will be saved, and we can spend the money on these things. And so we need to make sure that our representatives in government are doing the work that they can to make sure that we get those resources. Because Santa Cruz definitely has a need for more mental health and drug treatment capacity. Absolutely.
This judge position that you're going for is a 6-year stint, and then you get reelected again, potentially?
Yeah, you have to run every 6 years, and it's very uncommon for anybody to run against an incumbent. So usually it's just a matter of filing your name.
I've seen your signs everywhere. I haven't seen anybody else's signs everywhere. Who's paying for all those signs?
A variety of small donors.
Oh, really?
I mean, I put a bunch of money into the campaign myself. My folks have been very generous, but yeah, a lot of just, you know, anything from $100 to $500 donations from friends and colleagues. And
that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you enjoying the experience of running for election?
I really am. Yeah. It's fascinating. I've learned so much. I'm going to these organizations that I didn't really know existed previously. I'm meeting people I never would have met otherwise that are doing, there's a lot of people in Santa Cruz County doing really interesting things. We have a very robust, nonprofit community here.
We do.
Approaching,
there's new nonprofits every day.
There are, and they're addressing these issues like all over the world. It's great. We have a lot of really great things going on. I still work full time, and I have 3 kids, so it's exhausting.
Yeah,
and I'm not really, everything's getting neglected a little bit.
So it's gonna be, whatever happens, it's gonna be nice on Tuesday.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Went on the 6th. I'm gonna sleep in, hopefully, and yeah, I owe my wife, I think, a few nights away out of town.
Yeah.
When this is over.
Yeah, it sounds like every spare moment has been doing this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was out knocking on doors earlier today before I came here.
Yeah, so. I was kind of impressed by that. When you're knocking on doors, are you knocking on businesses or are you knocking on personal doors?
I've done both, but primarily I just go, I'll pick a neighborhood and I'll just go walk around and go door to door.
Is that a strange feeling?
at first I was really, I mean, it took me, I had to like really work myself up the first time I did it to like, okay, you know, here's what you're going to say and you got to go. And now I've just, I've been doing it so much. It's, I've got my shtick down and, it's been really interesting to see how people respond to you.
Yeah. What do people respond with?
For the most part, people are really, really nice and really interested. You know, you get some people who, you know, I'm not interested and close the door in your face, but that's been very rare.
So common on local ballot, you know, elections like this. I don't, it's just a name. I don't know who the person is.
Yeah.
Unless they happen to be someone I knew or something, or their sign's been up a lot, I know nothing about them. Especially since my grandmother passed away, who was actually much more involved with politics in Santa Cruz. I'd go in a couple days before election, I'd be like, hey, Shirley, tell me what's going on, who are you liking and all that, and we'd have discussions about it. But since her passing over a year ago, I don't have those conversations. So because I know you, I know about this position. So I'm assuming lots of times people are in that situation, they're just kind of glad to know something about who they're electing.
That's the power and benefit of going out and shaking hands with people, because they now have some connection to one of the parties, and that might be all it takes to get them to vote for you. And it's funny that you say that, because really, if you look at the things that we vote on, you know, the president, even your United States senator and representatives, voting for them is important, but, you know, district attorney, judge, you know, tax collector, these local offices, these are the things that are going to have some impact directly on your life. Maybe somebody who's going to go through a divorce at some point, they're going to be in front of a judge. Maybe somebody you care about gets a DUI. They're going to be in front of a judge. So these are things that this is the election that people should care about, because it is very intimate. It's very close to your own life.
But you've dealt with a lot of judges. Don't you in general feel like the people that get in the position of a judge are pretty decent people with good decision-making abilities? I mean, at least I hope our society works that way. It's the one part of government I actually kind of have faith in still.
You know, it's funny because you can get appointed or you can get elected. And I've heard people say, oh, we shouldn't be electing judges because it's making a non-political position political. And what I've learned is that the appointment process is every bit as political as an election, except it doesn't happen in the light of day.
Yeah.
And so I kind of now, I think I prefer the election. Because, you know, it's who's the people endorsing me, you know who they are. They're on my website. The people funding my campaign, you know who they are, because I have to report that information. Whereas, you know, thousands of attorneys will apply for appointment, and it's only with the right, you know, letters of recommendation. And, you know, there's people out there who are influential who can highlight your application and get you to those next steps. And there's that's not aired out at all. And so, you know, we're as a public, we're deprived of that information.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, the electoral process means that you have to trust good decisions of the electoral body.
Yeah,
and if you're polite and can knock on many doors, you can get the position. People aren't necessarily highly informed about your career, for example.
That's true, and that's one of the downsides to a republic or a democracy.
Yeah. Is it common for judges to be removed from the bench by misconduct? Have you ever known of it?
It's fairly uncommon. I can't think of anybody actually getting removed for...
We're doing something right.
Yeah, that's true.
Once
you're on the bench, everything you do, there's a record made of everything
do. Right.
And there's mechanisms for review. We have courts of appeal. And so, you know, you really have to... The whole saying sober as a judge comes from, you know, you're in this position where you're scrutinized both inside and outside of court. And you have to make sure that the decisions you're making are legal and supported by the facts and information. Absolutely.
Do you think, let's assume that you get the position, you're a judge next, I guess won't be a judge until Jeff resigns.
It'll be next January.
Okay. So in January, you become a judge officially. At that point, will you have to behave in any differently in your personal life? Will you not have discussions at the baseball game about politics and stuff? Like, do you think you'll have to restrict a bit about what you're thinking to make sure that you feel that you're still representing, you know, a center line?
There are ethical guidelines, and so you can't do anything that would reflect poorly upon the position that you're in. I'm painting very broad strokes here. Certainly, you probably want to be careful about the political positions that you voice, because you might at some point be in a position where you have to make a judgment about an issue. And if you have demonstrated some bias, then you may disqualify yourself from being able to do that. And you know, you're a public figure. So, you know, I guess no more like, you know, dancing on the tabletops at the bars late at night or anything like that. most of my free time is you know, just chasing my kids around. So I don't think it'll be too much of a life adjustment.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use your stuff any way you'd like. Just give us some credit. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell, producer of GeekSpeak. And today, I've been speaking with Zach Schwarzbach. He's an attorney in Santa Cruz, a public defender, and he's running for judge. Thank you so much for coming in today and geeking out with us about law.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
In the post show, I'm going to ask you two questions.
Okay.
Okay. First off, do you think it's appropriate for a judge to have a Metallica tattoo?
It's only Metallica font. It says Megan.
Oh.
That's my wife.
It's Megan. Your wife. Yeah, Megan. Yeah. Of course. So you have let me see it again.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Did you get that before you were married?
No. I got it. I can't remember what the occasion was. It was something I thought about for a long time. I was 30. Cool. I got it about 5 years ago.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. Now the more serious, I'm going to ask you some attorney question.
Yes.
Okay. Some advice. And you can totally do this flippantly and not answer it, and that's fine too.
Okay.
Last week, and I actually recorded this segment for last week's show, but I haven't actually broadcast it yet. So I might yank it or not, depending on what you say.
Okay.
So I went to I was taking the girls to the mall over the hill, my two daughters with two of their friends, so they could go shopping. I didn't want to hang out at the mall.
Listen to previous episode for full story.
You know, should I pay for it? And all this stuff goes on. I finally pull out Fandango and I buy a ticket for the next showing.
Okay.
That I'm not going to go see, right? So I've paid for it, if you will.
Yeah.
So the question I've got for you is what I've done illegal? Is it a misdemeanor? What, now that I've paid for it after the fact, I'm assuming nobody would choose to prosecute me. What are your thoughts about that?
So the crime would be, I think it's would fall within the statute. It's called disenfranchising an innkeeper. And it has to do with situations like that, or if you were to like bring your own liquor into a restaurant, you're depriving the person providing the service of making money on their service. But it sounds to me, if I was your lawyer in this case and you were getting prosecuted for it, I'd say it sounds to me like you intended to pay for the movie if you watched the whole thing. You never had the intention of going in there and seeing the movie without paying for it. So there's never an intent. There's never a criminal intent to commit a theft.
Even if there was a question of whether I was going to at all, I did pay for it later. Or is that like doesn't matter because
the
criminal
great.
Intent matters?
I mean, that's circumstantial evidence that you know, how do we prove you thought it? Exactly.
Like, I'm not even sure. Like when I'm walking through, I'm like, wow, I'm kind of a spy. I can get away with this. There was an exhilaration there,
mm-hmm.
and there was kind of an interest in like, oh, I got away with it. That's kind of neat.
Oh yeah.
But it was also like this feeling of guilt of like, oh, and is someone going to come and talk to me? You know, there's cameras obviously in the theater.
Sure, they know.
Could totally look and find out. Like, I could get prosecuted tomorrow for this potentially.
Yeah.
Right. So you're saying that it would be an easy case to present of intent because
I don't think you committed a crime, is what I'm saying.
Didn't I though? I hadn't paid for the ticket, I would have committed.
If you had never paid for the ticket, then I would say yes, you did. Because you took something that they sell.
That's obviously a crime.
Right.
Yeah.
But you ultimately paid for it. But I would say that even if, let's say, there's 10 minutes left, you're sitting waiting for the extra little clip after the credits, right?
Right.
That Marvel does.
Yeah.
You're sitting waiting
for
that.
Which I did wait for that. Was good.
Okay. Yeah.
Have you seen the new Avengers?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
So you're waiting for that. And the manager comes in and she looks at you and she goes, I remember this guy. And you know, there's no way he got in here because there was that big debacle happening out in front. And she comes up and says, hey, you know, you didn't pay for your ticket. And your response might be, oh, you know, I wasn't sure if I couldn't wait for that group. And I wasn't sure if the movie had started already. And if it had gotten past the credits, I didn't want to buy a ticket. So I came in to see and I saw it started. And I was planning on paying before I left.
She might
say go ahead and pay. Chances are if it's like an employee at a movie theater, they're thinking I don't want to lose my minimum wage job that I had to and that I'm now the manager at because I work so hard. I'm going to call the police and that's what my boss would want me to do.
Or but, she might go, okay, don't do it again. Don't worry about paying. I can't process
so
that.
Like we don't live in a society where they like say, oh, okay, don't, you know, we don't put up with mischief very, very,
yeah.
We don't have a good sense of humor anymore.
At the same level, maybe, because how much of a pain is it for her, right? She let somebody sneak in. Like, I don't know.
Well, I mean,
I'm almost curious. And there's also this level of like, you know, if she tries to, like, she might not want to call the police on me because what's, the, at some level, what's the point? But she also doesn't know how to process the ticket. She can't charge me.
Right.
The computer won't let her. So there's also that problem, right?
They can't just open up the cash register and take your cash anymore. Right.
Right. Well, I was actually had this kind of intellectual technical debate, because what I really wanted to do is I wanted to keep their Fandango service, of course, is taking a fee, and all the money that and that whole process is a whole API that the company's wearing. I don't really like that Fandango takes such a fee, but they do have a
fee too.
It's a big fee, but it's very convenient. And sure enough, I pay it all the time because it's so much easier than going to the theater first.
Right.
There's better technical solutions for this that doesn't have to have the middleman. The company itself that sells the ticket, that sells the service, doesn't really want Fandango in there, and no one really wants it, but it's the way it's set up. But in any case, I thought, well, wait a second. I could actually probably, if I went online to the website, I could probably figure out a way to actually charge the earlier time, because it's really just a form and authentication. I'd have to figure out. So I'm thinking about that. I'm like, yeah, if I subverted their technical system, that potentially could be the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a federal offense.
Yeah, there you go.
So I'm not going to get involved, so I just bought the next ticket. But anyway, so you're right, that she might have decided to charge or might not have decided to charge. But if you were to get that as a case, of course, it would look pretty good because I paid for it.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so another question is, though,
okay,
do I talk about this on a podcast at all? Is it insane to talk about that publicly?
I don't think you're going to get prosecuted for talking about this on a podcast, because, I mean, what was the ticket, $18 or something like that?
Yeah, San Jose. Yeah. With the fee for $45,
right?
Whatever it
right.
was. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Of course, you wouldn't want to say. I mean, if you had done something like that, you wouldn't want to talk about that because you're going to be a judge. You should never have that. Like that time decision to step over that rope was a decision to not necessarily steal something from them, but definitely go against the process that they want us to do when they're in their facility. So I wouldn't say it's trespassing, but at some level, it's like, until I buy a ticket, I'm not really supposed to be there.
But I think you have two competing kind of social interests there, because you have your criminal justice mindset, which is, well, you didn't buy the ticket, you don't get to cross the red rope. But we're also capitalists, right? And the true free market capitalism would say, well, you're as an informed consumer, you're entitled to inspect the goods that you're about to purchase, and certainly you don't want to buy at full price this ticket for a movie when you're going to miss. I mean, the first couple minutes of a movie is
especially for an Avengers movie,
it's so important.
You know what? I feel like I was a little lost anyway, even though I made it on time completely.
Right.
That opening scene with Thor, and he's got the beard and the whole thing, I felt a little bit like I was trying to catch up.
I came in late. Actually,
oh, really?
I think I missed about a minute.
Did you pay full price?
Yeah, I did.
You should totally have just walked over the road.
I think we took a bunch of kids, and so I was like, you know, I was probably actually going to get a beer at the Scotts Valley Theater. So.
Oh, man, I love that we have beer now.
It's so nice.
Oh, yeah. So good.
You know, it's like before you buy a car, you test drive the car, right?
Sure.
So, I don't know. There's competing social constructs there.
I wish that I had sat down and purchased the Fandango ticket right there, or purchased the Fandango ticket, and as I purchased the ticket, walked over the line and walked. Because it would have been just so much more cool to be like, use technology to do something that I wanted to do, like right at the moment. I just wish I'd done
Fandango,
it that way.
Experience is not quick enough, though. It's like
steps. Oh, that's true. I would have to choose my seat, the whole mess. Zach, thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.